Welcome back to the MERS Monday podcast. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. On this week's edition, a highly centralized budget-making process produced a record $76 billion fiscal year 2023 budget by July 1st, but not without some transparency issues. How can seemingly sane individuals dive into conspiracy theories? Robert Saylor, an Indiana-based research professor of religion and culture, explores the subject in light of theories of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election and the QAnon phenomenon. Also, how is trucker Randy Bishop, who got his political start as a Tea Party Republican in 2010, running as a Democrat in 2022? He answers this question and apologizes for comments he made earlier this year on his radio program about how a family should be a white mom, white dad, and white kids. Now here's MERS News editor Kyle Malin and reporter Samantha Schreiber.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. The House and the Senate has passed the budget for the coming fiscal year 2023. They did it on June 30 or July 1, which I suppose meets their statutory requirement to get the budget passed and to the governor and in the process by July 1. I guess that's the positive. The negative, I suppose, is we really didn't know what was in it until 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock on June 30. So certainly not the most transparent process.
I think it's definitely interesting because as reporters, when we started the budget rodeo, that's what I'll call it, we were really interested to see what this would mean for tax relief, what would this mean for EITC reform, for gas tax policy, affect gas tax vacation. And instead, what we had was a record-breaking budget, but a budget that also aims to reduce some of the debts that the state had and also kind of eliminate some of the excess spending protocols that were granted during the COVID-19 pandemic. So I would definitely describe this as a very post-COVID-19 era budget.
I think that's an accurate description. The reason we had $76 billion that we could spend as part of this budget with $7 billion left over is because of the money that the federal government had given us to try and jumpstart the economy during COVID-19. And then as part of that federal money, people went ahead and they bought stuff. And so we're getting more sales tax revenue. Unemployment numbers are not only low, job providers are looking desperately for help. So employment's not an issue. Income tax money is in. Real estate tax revenue is in. So we certainly have no problem with revenue. But why did the legislature and the governor not come to an agreement on some kind of tax cut?
You know, my head just keeps on wrapping around a question that I asked Senate Appropriations Chair Jim Stomas. I asked him, you know, what is the biggest challenge of a historic amount of money? And he kind of essentially said it's the historic amount of money itself. I mean, this was definitely a huge obstacle for lawmakers. How do you manage a number that you never could have anticipated when you first started in the legislature? Senator Stomas had actually said that it was more than $150 billion worth in request of different groups, different public officials, different interests, stakeholders, organizations making requests for this budget. So I think what we saw was kind of this epic frenzy of people really needing a historic budget. Obviously, we got historic K-12. We were able to continue increasing the foundation allowance for per pupils in public schools, and then also using that to kind of eliminate some of the debts that have been absorbed by various Michigan public universities. But as for when we talk about these tax relief items, I think that's something that's going to be saved for another day. You know, I think that there's still a lot more supplementals and a lot more big packages to be seen before 2022 ends.
You know, I think there is two things that we're working against getting some kind of agreement on a tax cut. First is kind of the technical aspect of it, in that they really, and I'm saying they, the House and Senate leadership, really centralized this process more than we've seen in the past. It wasn't the subcommittee chairs who sat down with themselves and the different departments and worked out compromises. This was the appropriations chairs and the budget director who basically came to an agreement on everything. And so just when you centralize that process, that in itself takes a lot of time to go through everything when you're not farming it out far and wide. So that process just from a technical nature takes a long time. The other one, I think, if you look at it from a political standpoint, I don't think that there was an advantage for the Republicans or the Democrats to spend this money quickly. For Governor Whitmer, I don't think she wants a tax cut like how the Republicans are viewing one. Because if she agrees on a gas tax holiday, for example, that holiday is going to have to expire. And if that holiday expires right around October 1 or let's say November 1 or somewhere around the election and all of a sudden gas goes back up 30 cents, that she's not going to want that. And then as far as like an income tax cut, she certainly doesn't want that because if she is the governor in 2 or 3 years and our revenue goes way down and we start entering a recession, she's going to have to make a bunch of cuts unless she can find a way to increase the income tax back to what it was. And she's not going to get any Republican support for that.
I mean, that kind of makes me snap back to our last conversation. And I do want to make a correction because last week I had said it was a report from the National Association of Retailers, but it was actually Realtors. Always messing up on my R words. I apologize. So many things are really indicating that the general revenue honeymoon that we experienced in 2020, 2021 is over. So like you just said, I mean, are we ever going to see a budget like this ever again? I honestly would say most likely not. I mean, people aren't purchasing houses the way that they were. People aren't purchasing cars the ways that they were. I mean, we are, you know, and then even Senator Stamos that said in a media scrum last night that the fear of a recession hovering in the future is very alive and well, especially among constituents in the state of Michigan.
And just to finish my thought here on, the Republicans don't necessarily need a tax cut right now either. They already have the governor on the record vetoing a gas tax holiday and an income tax cut twice. So they've already got her on record as having not supported it. In their minds also, they can wait until after the general election if they want to see if a Republican is victorious in November. And if that's the case, they are going to have a favorable outcome as far as they're concerned than if they negotiate something right now with Governor Whitmer. I mean, as far as they're concerned, they could get a sizable income tax cut with a Governor Rinke or a Governor Kelly or a Governor Tudor Dixon.
But at the same time, people are experiencing a lot of pain, a lot of worries, and a lot of fears right now. I mean, gas prices typically go up during the summer. It's about to be a pretty pricey summer at the pump with it being 4th of July weekend. I think at the end of the day, we are a group of people, humans in general. We like things fast. We like things served to us on an immediate silver platter. And I think even though this could create a shift in who's going to get, you know, an election victory, at the same time, I think there are still going to be people asking a lot of questions right now. In Tudor Dixon's case, though, I mean, she's getting so many endorsements. Did you see that she just got the Detroit News endorsement?
No.
Yeah. No, I just read their what they put out. I believe, I'm not sure when it was published, but pretty recently. I personally read it several hours ago. But she's kind of getting a lot of establishment backing that want to put her out as the business savvy candidate. But it's kind of interesting because it's also business savvy, but then it's also education issues.
Okay, I'm going to transition really hard, Samantha, now. We're going to go into our interview with our own Andrew Miniger and a professor into conspiracy theories, Robert Saylor. All right, Andrew, I know that we have been talking a lot in MERS about these America First candidates, many of whom believe that the election results were indeed fixed, that January 6th was an overblown event that was kicked off and spearheaded by the federal government itself to paint Donald Trump as an instigator for violence and insurrection. And we've talked about this many times before, but you decided to take it a step further and decide to reach out to folks who specialize in conspiracy theories.
Yeah, it seems to be there's a lot of a prominence of these popular conspiracy theories that have been, you know, propagated by people like Dinesh D'Souza with his 2,000 mules, and Alex Jones types that like to rile up the masses. It's interesting to see the psychology of how these conspiracy theories have made it into the mainstream of our political society and fabric, and have actually caused a lot of people that are running for governor, or not just governor, but all kinds of offices throughout the state, a lot put it into their platform that they're running on.
Introduce to our listeners our next guest.
This is Robert Saylor, and Robert Saylor is a professor, Christian Theological Seminary, as mm-hmm. well as at the Indiana University. He's teaching a class on conspiracy theory. So I thought it was an interesting cross-section of the religious aspects, the political aspects, and this whole conspiracy theory push that's been going on.
All right. Well, let's kick off with this then. Robert, how did you get into this particular subject?
As a historian of Christianity, and as someone who thinks about how Christianity has intersected with politics, with art, with culture across the centuries, very quickly, when you study that history, you realize that conspiracy, allegations of conspiracy, theorizing about conspiracy, has been a large part of how Christians have made sense of the world around them. I suspect that's true of other religious traditions, and we can think of examples of that as well. But my particular interests were historically, how have Christians interpreted, say, the Bible, prophecy, that sort of thing, in terms that we might be tempted to call conspiracy theory. And then to your point, when we move it to the present day, obviously conspiracy theory is tied deeply in with what we might recognize as Christian nationalism, support for growing alt-right reactionary populist movements across the globe, but certainly here in the United States as well.
Well, we'll go start ahead. Off with Christian conspiracy theory going back. Just give us an example of something that you can point to historically that Christians hinge their faith on that could be described nowadays as a conspiracy theory.
Well, depending on how central it is to the faith or not, certainly in terms of how Christians have been in the world, and I speak as a Christian myself, I want to be very clear about this, so this is inside criticism of my own tradition. One of the most prominent examples would be how Christians have related to Jewish people in the early church, and then particularly in the medieval period. There was a great deal of Christian conspiracy speculation around what we would now recognize as things like blood libel, this idea that somehow Jews were participating in horrible kinds of rituals involving the blood of Christians, say innocent children. That's a particularly cogent example now, because QAnon, which I would describe as an amalgamation of a number of existing conspiracy theory themes. One of those major themes is something akin to blood libel. That is this idea that the blood of innocents is being harvested, used as part of sadistic rituals. QAnon gives that its own twist. But what I'm saying is that Christian speculation around the nefariousness of Jewish people, obviously, that plays a huge role, say, in World War II in Germany, how Hitler was able to capitalize on Christian support for the Nazi Party, up to and including ultimately persecution of Jews, the final solution. That is drawing on a long-running strand of not only Christian antagonism towards Jews, but specifically this idea that Jews are always involved in the kind of global cabal to influence the media, to influence government institutions, and so on.
So given that, there seems to be this schism between the secular and religious aspects of the people who believe in these conspiracy theories. And it seems that a lot of these, like you mentioned QAnon, they stem from the same source. But if you ask somebody in the religious aspect, hey, what you believe this, are you a QAnon person? And they will deny it. They will say, no, I don't believe anything that QAnon has. I mean, where do you think that split takes place?
Yeah, it's very tricky. A number of scholars have pointed out that when we talk about something, say, like Christian nationalism, that's a very complex phenomenon. For instance, sociologists Andrew Whitehead and Samuel Perry have pointed out in their work that at a certain point, the intensity of Christian nationalist sentiment, and by that I mean this idea that America is a Christian nation, ought to remain a Christian nation, and needs to be defended from any nefarious force that would try to reduce the role of Christianity in the government. The intensity of that sentiment at a certain point actually is negatively correlated with church attendance. In other words, what I'm saying is for a while, Christian nationalism and actual church attendance rise together, but then at a certain point, they diverge. So what does it mean then to say that religion is playing a role? Well, it depends on whether you mean religion in the sense of active church attendance or religion in the sense of a kind of political vision whereby Christian values ought to be at the center of the United States. So that's one backdrop. But then the other backdrop, Andy, I think in response to your question, has to do with the fact of nothing is immune to politicization and polarization right now. So for instance, we see this in terms of strong, in some sectors, strong Christian resistance to COVID-19 vaccines, specifically along the idea that somehow either the vaccines or indeed the entire pandemic represents a kind of conspiracy designed by nefarious actors within the government to curtail rights, shut down churches, that sort of thing. And there you get into historic oppositions between certain modes of religious understanding and science, distrust of government establishments, fear that the government is going to persecute Christians in this country, all of this question of the religious secular divide around conspiracy theory is tied in with these much broader questions of how Christians have understood relationship to the government writ large.
Can you kind of talk to how those that polarization has amplified those conspiracy theories into the mainstream?
Yeah. So, I mean, QAnon is a great example of, and my students laugh at me because I sort of describe QAnon in these terms like, oh, it's so brilliant and it's so effective. I'm not a fan of QAnon, but as someone who studies this, I am intrigued by how durable and malleable some of these themes are. And part of what allows for something like QAnon to be mainstreamed, I would say two things. One would be the role of social media, not just sort of the mainstream platforms like Facebook and Twitter, but what we might think of as the darker corners of the web. QAnon begins, for instance, largely as a phenomenon tied to message boards, 8chan, 4chan, and so on. And why is that significant? Well, it means a couple of things. One, it means that QAnon, in fact, has no source. It has no head. There's still disagreement as to whether, as to where the original QAnon drops in 2017 came from. But I think even more important than the question of where did they come from originally is the fact that the phenomenon itself very quickly became a leaderless phenomenon. It's not at all apparent, for instance, that all of the drops representing themselves as Q drops all came from the same place. And that matters because when we think about intervening then, when we think about, well, how are we going to cut the head off this snake? There's no head to cut off. So that's a piece of it. Another piece is that it allows for what I would call different levels of buy-in. So you mentioned earlier, if you ask someone, oh, are you a QAnon believer? Even people who are fairly invested in it might say no, because what they have in mind is the entire complex of the mythology. You know, oh, adrenochrome is being harvested from children, lizard people, deep states, George Soros, all the different multifaceted aspects of this mythology. It's almost like the Marvel Universe, right? It just keeps getting more and more complicated. The thing about QAnon is you don't have to buy into the whole thing. So to maybe extend the Marvel movie analogy, you can watch one of the movies, enjoy it, and not be connected to the whole, whereas some people are going to get deeply invested into the entire thing, right? So there are these different levels of buy-in, and part of the insidious brilliance of a lot of social media is that it provides a curated path by which someone who dips their toe in one aspect can be led down the path. The most significant example of that, I think, in the case of QAnon, is the way in which the movement got a kind of a major second wind when it shifted away from focusing on political enemies, on the deep state, Hillary Clinton and so on, and moved more towards what became the Save Our Children campaign that popped up all over social media. All of a sudden, I saw this, maybe you did too, all of a sudden my friends were starting to share these Save Our Children, Protect Our Children memes. And of course, on the surface, it's not only innocuous, it's praiseworthy, right? Who wouldn't be against combating human trafficking, child trafficking? But we now see that that was a stepping stone towards drawing people into this idea, which has been present in QAnon from the beginning, that somehow there are these pedophiles, these people doing horrible things to children, that are at the base of this deep state opposition to President Trump. So my point is that I think the online aspects of this that allow for different levels of buy-in, and then also a curated path to draw you in deeper and deeper and deeper, that is very significant in this case.
So what's the end? To what end do people contribute to this QAnon, I guess, fabric that's being created out there?
I think, and this is where, first of all, it's a very good question, because unlike with some other conspiracy theories, it's not clear that anyone's making a lot of money off of QAnon, for instance. There have been some entrepreneurial types that have sold t-shirts and that sort of thing, but in general, money does not seem to be the main motivation. And also, sort of direct political electoral power also does not seem to be a primary motivation. As you indicate, there certainly are political candidates, including Donald Trump, who have leveraged QAnon for political gain. But you're right that that doesn't seem to be the main impetus. So what is? My piece of an answer to that question would be this. Part of what has been attractive about conspiracy theories for a long time has been that they can either make a complicated world seem very simple, or it can make uncomfortably simple facts seem complicated. That is a large part of the psychology of conspiracy theories. Let me give you an example that we spend a lot of time talking about in class, and our students are very brave for how much they wrestle with this. You mentioned Alex Jones earlier. One of the major conspiracy theories that Alex Jones made his contemporary reputation on was the aftermath of the Sandy Hook shooting, this horrible slaughter of children. That very early on, disturbingly early on after that shooting, Alex Jones and others are saying this was a false flag operation. This was either staged or worse, it was carried out by the government in order to restrict gun rights. Why, in the face of such horrific tragedy, would that narrative not only be promulgated to great profit by Alex Jones, but believed by so many people? Well, I think one piece of the answer to that, and this gets into the religion side of this, is that religions for a long time have tried to make sense of the fact that we say that we live in a world that is somehow governed by justice, goodness, mercy, God, but yet these horrible, evil things happen. How can we make sense of that? And as disturbing as it is in the case of a Sandy Hook conspiracy believer to believe that the government would either fake or carry out an atrocity like this, I think there is a psychological comfort in believing, oh, but at least we don't have to face up to the fact that we live in a world in which this sort of thing happens. And there is no real explanation for it.
I'm starting to think now of the X-Files and Fox Mulder's poster in his office that says, "I want to believe." And that kind of sounds like what I'm hearing here is that these folks want to believe that it was a conspiracy, that it was a false flag, that it didn't really actually happen, because then you'd have to wrestle with the fact that it did happen, and these people aren't ready to do that.
I think that's right. And another key aspect of conspiracy theory thinking is that once you have psychologists talk about it in terms of once you've started to engage in a costly belief, that is a belief that you know is unpopular, that you know is putting you at odds, maybe with friends and family, and certainly with the broader public, it is increasingly difficult to shake someone from that belief because you've invested so much. And if it turns out that you were wrong, then you've really lost something. And all of us psychologically are wired to where if we go all in on something, to where we've really are going to lose something if we turn out to have been proven wrong, then that means that being confronted with facts, dissenting facts, may actually have the effect of causing us to double down. In other words, it increases our attachment to our belief rather than mollifying or dissuading them, which is why when you're dealing with someone who is deeply entrenched in conspiracy theory, simply presenting alternate facts not only often does not work, oftentimes it prompts deeper clinging to the belief itself.
Well, that actually goes into my next question about how they people come out of this, and at the point that they've been confronted and they see with their own eyes that this conspiracy is not real, like this is actually the reality of what's going on. What are some of the reactions of people?
Yeah, this is a fantastic question. And I think when it comes to deprogramming people from conspiracy theory, particularly those that are harmful. And I mean, let's just pause for a second. I mean, all of us might believe things that we that are not necessarily provable or might be a little wacky. Obviously, as someone in religious studies, you know, many people would say what Christians believe or what Buddhists believe or what Muslims believe, oh, you can't prove it, therefore it's a little wacky. But at a certain point, a line is crossed when you say, okay, if somebody happens to believe in the flying spaghetti monster, that might be a little weird, but it's not doing anyone any harm. Over into, look, if you believe that the government slaughtered children in Sandy Hook, or that the government is in the throes of a deep state operation, now you're doing harm and you're perpetuating harm by believing that. So if you feel that someone is in the grips of a conspiracy theory that is causing them harm, then I think what a lot of people are doing is they're learning from the experience and the tactics of people that have done things like deprogramming people from white supremacist gangs or racial ideology hatred. So for instance, I really like the work of a man named Christian Piccolini, who is a former white supremacist gang member and musician, who now has dedicated his life to helping to deprogram people, be an intervention for people who are deep in white supremacist movements. And two things about his work. One is that I think he correctly identifies that what is at stake here is what he calls identity, community, and purpose. That is, being a part of a conspiracy theory can give you this real thrill of belonging. It can give your life meaning. You are on the side of the truth over and against the majority that disbelieves this. That's not only thrilling emotionally, it also bestows a kind of identity. And so if you're going to deprogram someone from that, you have to be able to take that seriously and think through, well, what is the positive then? If this goes away, what is there for them on the other side? And then I think also his work shows sometimes you need insiders, formers in the movement who can not only speak the language, but who have credibility to sort of lead people out of that path. There are a number of studies, for instance, of gambling addicts who say the most effective interveners for someone who is in a gambling addiction tend to be former gambling addicts themselves. Again, not only because they know the mindset from the inside, but because they can sort of speak convincingly to the logic of the person who's caught in it and sort of give them
an out
and a kind of honorable out. It's like, oh no, you're not a complete fool. It's not like you were completely stupid. There were reasons why you believed what you believed. It just happened to be based on the wrong grounding assumptions. And so here's a dignified way to get out.
And I think you are seeing that among Republicans as they're talking about trying to wean people off of this idea that widespread fraud cost Donald Trump the election by saying there was fraud. And I think most Republican candidates out there will say there was fraud in the election, just not as much as we thought. And this is where the fraud was. There were folks who were dead at the time they or dead by the time the election happened, but they cast an absentee ballot. You know, they can say anecdotal things that happened that would give these folks an out and say, yeah, well, I guess there was fraud that happened, without admitting, you know, without just flat out saying you're a buffoon. There is no proof of widespread fraud that cost Donald Trump the election.
That's right. And, you know, and we have to be sensitive to context, too. Right. So, for instance, when you think about COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy, that plays out differently, for instance, if you're a person of color in the United States versus whether you're a white person. If you are, say, an African-American in the United States, you have within living memory the Tuskegee experiments, for instance, when the government and the medical establishment was involved in a conspiracy to the detriment of black and brown bodies. So that means that that doesn't mean that there shouldn't be an attempt to really think through, okay, how do we overcome vaccine hesitancy among African-Americans in the country? It just means being very cognizant of the fact that conspiracy theory sometimes have turned out to be true.
I was wondering how people go about viewing these things, like the overall wrap up of the conspiracy theory and that intersection of the religious, political aspects of this whole ball of wax.
I think in here again, I'm going to speak as a Christian, sort of to my fellow Christians. Religious language in general has, as part of our history, rich and very intense language of spiritual warfare, not only sort of combating, you know, between the forces of good and the forces of evil, but at least in terms of where I see it as most helpful, it's about looking within. It's not, oh, the evil out there versus the good, innocent me. It's, I look within myself and I recognize the ways in which I am culpable. I am at fault, not only for what I do individually, but for the systems that I'm a part of. I think what we see in religion and conspiracy theory is a very dangerous slippage whereby all of a sudden that language of spiritual warfare gets attached to very human opponents. So all of a sudden, it's not about overcoming the sin in me, say, it's about, oh, there's this external dark forces of a deep state or pedophiles or people conspiring to steal the election, overturn the election. Religion, I think, carries within it the potential for deep good in terms of calling all of us to a space of grace, understanding, bearing with each other, humanizing each other. But those same traditions also carry this potentially dangerous tendency to literally demonize the other and to give religious sanction to it. And so at the seminary where I teach, what I try to do and what I hope happens more of is that religious people, I don't think the answer is pulling religion out of the public square. I think it's a matter of saying, how do religious people draw on the best of their tradition to say, no, we see what is human in the other, we see what is flawed in ourselves, and that keeps us from demonizing the other or seeing the world in these sort of black and white antagonistic terms. But I think that's exactly the moment in history we're in. That's exactly what is in flux. There are real questions as to how religious traditions are going to respond to that.
Robert Saylor, a research professor of religion and culture, associate dean for evolution, and executive director of the Center for Pastoral Excellence at the Christian Technological Seminary in Indianapolis. Thank you so much for joining us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You know, Andrew, he is a doctor in theology, right? A doctor, Dr. Saylor. I don't think we're supposed to use that as AP form, but something he left us with that I thought was interesting. He shared with us the definition of a conspiracy and a conspiracy theory. And those are two different things.
Yes, they are. Definitely. Because conspiracy is just, you know, a legal term. You know, could it actually happen? Yes, it absolutely could.
A conspiracy theory, he says, is a proposed explanation of an historical, ongoing, or future event that cites as a main causal factor a small group of powerful persons, the conspirators, acting in secret for their own benefit against the common good. That's the conspiracy theory. A conspiracy is a secret arrangement between two or more actors to usurp political or economic power, violate established rights, hoard vital secrets, or unlawfully alter government institutions. Basically, one is something that could actually be happening, and another is just an explanation, a product of your own imagination or somebody's imagination.
Absolutely. You know, and there's a lot of vibrant imaginations out there.
There is indeed. Joining us now on the podcast is the Democratic State Senate candidate in the 37th District. It is Randy Bishop. So are you still going by Trucker Randy?
Trucker Randy is my moniker for my radio talk show that I do 9 to noon Monday through Friday on the radio station, 97.7 FM WCHY Sheboygan, and my website is yourdefendingfathers.com. Trucker Randy is the moniker that got me started in politics. Back in 2010, when I ran against Howard Walker as the Tea Party Republican and had no idea, Kyle, about parties. I had no idea about county parties. I basically filed my affidavit of identity after Howard Walker hung up on me. And that's what got me into politics. And I was on the radio quite a bit with my previous partners and been on the air now over 10 years. And just went over 8,000 clock hours on the microphone.
Wow, congratulations. So tell our listeners how you went from being a conservative Tea Party Republican to filing as a Democrat in 2022 for the state Senate.
Well, very simply, I got kicked out of the Republican Party back in 2018. I actually resigned when I was the chairman of the Antrim County Republican Party because I had the audacity to travel 238 miles from my driveway up to Escanaba in the 38th State Senate District. And I endorsed Scott Dianda, the former 110th Democratic State Representative for the Senate to run against Ed McBroom in the 38th. And I got so much flack and I got so much threats and attacks that I just said, you know what? After Bill Schuette gets his ass kicked by Gretchen Whitmer by 10 points. I was actually off. He lost to Whitmer by 9.57%. I left the party. I resigned and I said, that's it. I've had it with you guys. I've had it with the Republicans and the Democrats. I've just had it. And I've been without a party for the last 4 years. I looked at the district after the redistricting of the map. It's 55% Republican, 42% Democrat up here in the 37th State Senate District. And I looked at the two candidates running, Barbara Conley. She's been endorsed by all 8 county Democrat parties up here. She's an oncologist, an elderly doctor, partially retired from her practice. I went to her website. I looked at her platform and I said, this woman can't win in November. There's absolutely no way she can beat any of the Republican candidates. Jimmy Schmidt is in Central Lake. God bless him for running, but he can't win in November either. And I said, you know what? I can beat all 4 of the Democrats. I don't care which one becomes their candidate. I can beat them because I'm running as a common sense businessman. And if you go to my website, randybishop.org, and click on issues, you'll see what I will lead on in Lansing as the 20th Democratic senator in Lansing. And that's what made me decide. I filed at 3:30 on the last day, April 19th. I said, because if I can get the nomination as a Democrat, I can flip the Senate. I can be the 20th senator in the Democratic caucus to give them majority control in the Senate and get a voice of common sense business ideas that they as a party need to adopt to fix the state of Michigan. And that's exactly why I decided to run.
But let's say we get down to the issues, though. Do you actually identify as a Democrat? If so, how so? Or did you just essentially see an opportunity here and decided to run with it?
I am a John F. Kennedy Democrat. And I know, Samantha, you're too young to remember him. But I am a fiscal conservative. I'm pro-life. I am so pro-life, I don't have any exceptions for it. Not even rape, incest, or the death of the mother. I'm pro-Second Amendment. I am a Bart Stupak Democrat here in the 37th race. Common sense, business things that could be and should be introduced to fix the state of Michigan is what the Democrat Party is failing on. The Republican Party is failing on it. Just look at this ridiculous budget they voted on at 2:21 this morning. $76 billion for a state that has 10 million people in it. Georgia, same population as us. I looked up their fiscal year 2023 budget, $30.2 billion. How is it we have a budget 2.53 times, 2.5 times more than the state of Georgia with the same population of people? It's called forensic accounting. It's called knowing how to run a financial calculator. It's knowing business, knowing how to introduce things that will fix the state. These social issues, identifying as a Democrat, it's irrelevant to this race, irrelevant to the state of Michigan. If the Democrats want to win and they truly want to fix the state of Michigan, they got to abandon all these issues that are losers with the people of the state of Michigan, especially here in the 37th state Senate district.
So another question that I have, though, is that Democrats in this election year, I mean, they're really going to run hard with abortion, given the recent Roe v. Wade overrule with the Dobbs case. And they're also going to be running really hard with gun safety and firearm reform. You know, when you think about entering into a caucus, entering into a community, I mean, how are you going to align with those members when you're kind of the exact opposite in your personal philosophies?
The caucus focusing on those issues with a Republican controlled House is going to go nowhere. It may pass in the Senate if I'm the 20th senator, perhaps giving them the Senate majority leadership. But the problem is they're not focusing on the things that matter to the people of the state of Michigan. Those two issues you just brought up are losers in the Republican House. Republicans are not going to lose the House. The map is favoring them. They've got the candidates. They have a chance to flip the Senate, but the House will stay Republican. And I don't care if the Speaker is Matt Hall or Matt Maddox. They're not going to take those bills up. Look at what happened this morning when they tried to pull a bill to the floor out of committee regarding repealing basically the 1931 abortion ban. It went nowhere.
Do you believe that Republicans and Democrats, incumbents currently in the legislature, do you feel like they kind of screwed themselves over by not passing any type of tax relief in this recent budget that came out this morning?
Voting for the highest budget in the history of the state of Michigan, every single elected official in Lansing, both in the House and the Senate, should not be reelected. They completely do not understand we the people. They don't know the pain we're going through. You got to get us some tax relief. And if you don't have the guts to put it in the first draft to the governor, because she surely isn't going to add it, it's completely insane that they would even vote for this. Every single person who voted for it needs to be voted out in a primary on August 2nd or in November. We need leadership. We need business people. We need veterans. We need people with leadership skills to go down there and say, guys, we need a forensic accounting of every department. There's enough money, there's enough fat in every single one of those bureaucratic departments' budgets that could be cut by 20% across the board. 20% chop to the budget could pay for personal income tax being eliminated, corporate income tax, fixing the property tax structure we have in this state. Non-homestead needs to go. Many bureaucratic departments need to go. They're outdated. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're being completely mismanaged. Their efficiencies are low. They are not doing the job for we the people of the state of Michigan. This is what the Democratic caucus needs to listen to.
Trucker, are you still endorsing Garrett Celdano for governor?
Personally, I did that back in September when he held his event here in Antrim County at Frisky's Farm Market while the Republicans were at the leadership conference on Mackinac Island. That was before Kevin Rinke, Perry Johnson got into the race. I personally did that. I don't go back on my personal endorsements.
Can you tell our listeners what happened here with this comment that got some publicity in Lansing, when you said that I can't even watch a college basketball tournament without commercials telling me I have to feel guilty because I think a family should be a white mom, a white dad, and white kids?
Combination of three things that was happening. First of all, I don't take phone calls on my show. I don't have a call screener. I'm a one-man show. I take text messages. If you want to get a text message, a comment into my show, I've trained my listeners, please be relevant on topic to the conversation. We had started talking about the media, and we started talking about shows, and we started talking about commercials and how all these things are factoring in where they're trying to condition the general public thinking about certain social issues and relationships. Honestly, Kyle, I was reading text comments from my listeners. I misspoke. It was not what I meant to say personally. Okay. I screwed up. I flat out screwed up. What came out of my mouth was not what my heart is not what my brain is. I misspoke, and I've apologized. I've tried to explain it to people, but they keep wanting, you know, bringing it back up.
Now, if you were to be elected, I know Sylvia Santana said she'd like you to go through some racial sensitivity training before you caucus with the Dems. What do you think of that?
I will absolutely go through that training and hopefully be forgiven for my misstatement.
I want to take a quick little pivot back to talking about your Garrett Celdano endorsement. How would you describe the current state of the, you know, the battle to find the candidate who will go up against Governor Whitmer in the November election? What do you think of this slate of candidates and the state of the Michigan Republican non-Whitmer voting community?
I feel that Governor Whitmer misled us back in 2018 when she said, elect me and I'll fix the damn roads. In May, there was a couple studies done. Even MDOT has admitted this. 42% of our roads are still in poor condition. When you run on something back in 2018, and here we are 2022, and we've got 42% of our roads in poor condition, you lied to the people of Michigan. I feel she did not do what she got elected to do. MDOT needs to be eliminated. The money needs to go to the local county road commissions. We know where the potholes are locally, and let the counties compete against one another who can fix the roads the best. There are so many other issues that she has failed on that has caused damage to businesses and to families, especially up here in the 37th Senate District. The reason I think we need somebody to debate her is to force her to raise her game. If she wants to get reelected, she's got to get reelected on she will do this and commit to it. And when I look at the other candidates, I don't think anybody else can hold her accountable and debate her on a debate stage, forcing her to committing to fixing truly what's wrong with the state of Michigan. I think Garrett can do it.
So you know the numbers for the state Senate. You know this is going to be tight. Trucker, if you are or you end up being the 20th vote for the Democrats, will you vote Winnie Brinks for majority leader?
I would like to have a meeting with her when I'm elected. I want to have a private sit down with her. And there's two things that I want, Kyle. If they want me to caucus and seriously talk to them in caucus meetings, she wants my support to be the next Senate Majority Leader. I want to be the chair of Appropriations and I want to be the chair of education. Those are two things I am going to demand for her to get my vote to be the Senate Majority Leader.
And then you'll vote with the Democrats for, in exchange for the loyalty.
No, I said I would vote for her to be the Senate Majority Leader.
Okay.
Now, voting with the Democrats is depending on the bills.
Okay.
I introduced the bills to get rid of the state income tax because I'm going to eliminate bureaucratic departments in the budget as chairman of the budget committee. I'm going to get rid of the Liquor Control Commission. There's absolutely no reason why we should have a Liquor Control Commission in the state of Michigan. I'm going to get rid of MDOT. I'm going to get rid of MDOT. Why do they have five airplanes in a hangar in Lansing right now? Why, when you go by an MDOT road project, one guy's in the hole with a shovel and five guys are standing up on the ground smoking cigarettes, managing him? When Elmer's repaved Grandview Parkway over by the state park with the overhead right there on the front street, you call it whatever you want to call it, Munson Avenue. Elmer's got that whole paving project done, Kyle, in 10 days. They were working at night. A local contractor got the bid and did the work. That should be done in all 83 counties. Southeastern Michigan, their roads suck. Macomb County, Oakland County, Wayne County road commissions are the ones who should be fixing the roads in their counties, not MDOT. It's completely overly managed, mismanaged, and not efficient. And I'm going to introduce this in the budget package. I will sell and convince Democrats and Republicans to support it. Because if we fix the state, all these other issues that we're talking about, abortion, gun rights, has nothing to do with getting businesses and people to move back to our state. We got to break up the monopoly, DTE and Consumers Energy's monopoly. 90% of our electric grid, people in the UP, Kyle, they're paying 34, 36 cents a kilowatt hour for electricity. It's ridiculous. 1,000 square foot manufactured home, $350 a month for electricity in Nugani. That's crazy.
What about education? What would you do with that committee?
Go to my website, randybishop.org, click on issues. Public schools, it's even in the new budget, bragging about how they finally increase per pupil funding. You can fix the public schools with one word, competition. I would put in the budget $14,000 for every kid in the state of Michigan to get an education. Public schools would love it. Oh my God, $14,000 guaranteed? Yes, but it comes with a catch. It follows the kid. If they want to go to a private school, a Christian school, homeschooling, charter school, whatever, they get a MyEDU card, kind of like a bridge card with 14 grand on it, and the parents can pay the tuition to any school they want. Through competition, the public schools would be forced to be better. They would be forced to compete with other schools in their areas in order to retain the students in that 14 grand. Homeschooling parents, you got three kids, you have $42,000 to buy laptops and DVDs and go on field trips and do whatever you want. They would be competing. Yes, I know there's an amendment that you have to repeal in order to get us to fund that money into these other schools, but they need competition. What we have right now in public schools is not working. I don't care how much money you throw at it. It's not going to work unless you have competition.
Last question I wanted to get to, Trucker Randy. Folks who are listening to this program are going to say, there's no way this guy is going to get elected as a Democrat in Northern Michigan. Why are they wrong?
They're wrong because the current Democrat candidates will lose in November. They cannot win. I guarantee Barbara Conley or Jim Schmidt will lose to the Republican, whichever Republican there is. If I am the candidate, I can kick the Republicans' butts because I have sound, common sense business ideas that the people of the 37th Senate District will respond to. Kyle, I only got to get 20% of the Republican vote. If I get 42% of the Democrats because I have a D behind my name and I'm their candidate, and I pull 20% of the 55% of the Republicans, I'm the next state senator. And I'm going to go to Lansing, and I'm going to absolutely upset the apple cart. It's got to be changed. Leadership needs to be pressured to do the right thing. The governor needs to be fought with a budget that works for the state, fixes all the problems we have, and attract more companies and businesses and jobs back to our state. We should be at 14 million people, not 10. And I'm the senator that is bold enough to introduce these ideas, to show the leadership, and to sell it to both the Democrats in the Senate, the House, and get all the Republicans to get on board. Lightning rod, yes, that's exactly what I'm going to be when I go to Lansing.
You already have some money into this. I saw that you had some television commercials up there. So it's not like you're just sitting at home and being a Facebook warrior here.
No, I've got ads running on TV. We're going to be also running the last 2 weeks before the August 2nd primary during primetime news on all the networks up here. And it just says the truth. If my candidates that I'm running against are elected, they can't win in November. I can. So vote for me. Democrats, if you're smart, you'll pick me to run up against the Republicans, and I will kick their butt.
Trucker Randy Bishop, he is a candidate in the 37th State Senate District and obviously host of a popular radio program up there up north. Thank you so much for taking time with us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Samantha.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is done by Mark Bayshore out of Okemos. And
happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July. What are you doing for the 4th of July, Kyle?
I will be in a place far, far away on the other end of the globe.
Do you talk about journalism or Lansing when you're on vacation ever?
Not if my wife can help it. And where I'm going to be, I doubt that that will come up. But here's an interesting thing, though. On the Saturday that we're leaving, Donald Trump is going to be at the Anchorage airport.
Oh, my goodness. There's your opportunity.
I've seen him a few times.
Get some clips.
I suppose. I brought that up to Bridge. I don't think she's...
She's interested in seeing former President Donald Trump on a family vacation.
I didn't get the sense that that was on the table.
I'll be honest. After a late night budget session coverage time, I'm definitely really excited to zone out this weekend. I am going to be on a pink flamingo float. I'm going to be reading my books, and I'm going to have a very magical 4th of July weekend.
All right. Well, I hope everybody who's listening has a great and equally pleasurable 4th of July weekend. Until next time. And for Samantha Schreiber, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care. We'll be right back.